You have always been most kind to those of us who are ordinarily classed merely as troublesome young men. Harold Macmillan to Winston Churchill, January 1928. They were schooled at Eton and Harrow, Cambridge and Oxford. They lived in Belgravia and Mayfair and spent their weekends at sprawling country houses in Kent, Sussex and Oxfordshire. They were part of the small, clubby network that dominated English society. And now, in May 1940, these Tory members of Parliament were doing the unthinkable, trying to topple Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, the leader of their own party, from power. They knew they were courting political suicide. They were challenging a powerful authoritarian Prime Minister who equated criticism of his policies with treason and employed a full complement of dirty tricks to stamp out dissent. Opponents branded the rebels as unpatriotic. Sir Samuel Hoare, the Home Secretary, denounced them as jitterbugs and claimed that their alarm and scaremongering had thwarted a new golden age of tranquility in Europe. Like other former public schoolboys, the small band of backbenchers had been taught to value loyalty. But in the current crisis, they believed they owed loyalty to their country, not to their party or prime minister. For 8 months, Britain had been at war with Germany, a war that Chamberlain and his government clearly had no interest in fighting, a war being waged, as one Tory rebel said, without arms, without faith, and without heart. Defending Poland was the ostensible reason why Britain and France had declared war on Hitler's Germany the previous September. But Poland had been quickly devastated by the German invasion and its Western allies, despite all the treaties and all the promises to that shattered country, did nothing to save it. Was there any other justification for continuing this putative conflict? If so, Chamberlain's government never said what it was. The government declined to declare its war aims and seemed to prefer a token war, waged as cheaply as possible. The British army was undermanned, ill-equipped, and badly organized. Mobilization was lethargic. Able-bodied men were still working as chauffeurs and as doormen at London's private clubs and luxury hotels. Armament production was proceeding at a snail's pace, and few, if any, controls had been imposed on civilian manufacturing. Throughout Great Britain, there was doubt, cynicism, apathy, and distrust. When war was declared, the British braced themselves to bear the shock, believing their cause was just. But when their leaders turned their backs on Poland and nothing more happened, the sense of mission evaporated. More than 1 million city dwellers had been evacuated to the countryside. A blackout had been imposed, causing tremendous disruption and danger. And for what? Where were the bombs? What was the rationale for turning everyone's life upside down? Why were the wealthy still throwing lavish parties and drinking champagne at posh nightclubs while workers struggled with shortages and skyrocketing costs? To his radio listeners in America, the CBS correspondent Edward R. Murrow reported that the people of Britain felt the machine is out of control, that we are all passengers on an express train travelling at high speed through a dark tunnel toward an unknown destiny. The suspicion recurs that the train may have no engineer, no one who can handle it. Hitler, meanwhile, had no doubts about where he was heading. His forces had taken full advantage of the inertia of Britain and France, knifing through Poland the previous autumn, then in April, invading Denmark and routing the British Army and Royal Navy from Norway. German troops were now poised to launch a lightning sweep through the heart of Western Europe, striking toward the English Channel. Socially and militarily, Britain teetered on the edge of disaster. Yet there appeared to be little hope for change. Chamberlain was determined to stay in power, and most of the massive Tory majority in the House of Commons seemed determined to support him. So were the BBC and the nation's newspapers. Such support was in the national interest, editors rationalized. Criticizing the government in time of war would be disloyal, they declared, splitting the country further and only helping the Germans. This, then, was what the Tory insurgents faced as they plotted to oust Neville Chamberlain. It was the climax of a 2-year struggle against his policy of appeasement of Nazi Germany that had begun with the resignation of Anthony Eden as Foreign Secretary in February 1938.